Did you know your calendar age doesn't always match how old your body truly is? At least according to the True Age test from True Diagnostic. Biological age shows how fast you're aging internally, and it's a key predictor of serious disease risk. Research says if your biological age is just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk for diseases like cancer or heart disease can spike by 30 to 50%. The good news? You have influence over your true age through lifestyle, habits, and environment. I was surprised to learn my blood has fewer toxins than most, but I'm deficient in vitamin C and B2, and I need to eat more valine-rich foods like nuts, dairy, and meat. The True Age test was a breeze. Just a quick finger prick at home, no doctor visit needed. You mail it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, you get a detailed report on your aging. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head out to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. We are now live on the Conversations That Matter podcast. Again, we're trying this again. If you are in channel, let me know if everything is sounding okay. That was the issue a few moments ago when I tried to start recording is people couldn't understand, I guess, what I was saying because the volume was too low on my microphone. So hopefully the volume is okay now. I'll wait on someone to let me know whether it is to see if I need to make any adjustments. But we have a lot to talk about today. I couldn't fit all the topics on the title for this particular podcast, and I won't review everything I said in the 5 minutes before when I was broadcasting. Okay, Nick says it sounds good, so we're going to keep going here. But we're going to talk about the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm going to give you an update on that. I'm going to talk about the big project that I've been involved in, series of projects, really, on documenting SBC-related or affiliated church takeovers. I don't know how else to put it. I wrote a long piece for American Reformer on this. There's a shorter piece in the Federalist. I would appreciate it if you go ahead and share those if you are a listener of this podcast. I want those articles to get out there far and wide. I've already had about six or seven people contact me with other churches going through similar situations, according to them. I think it's happening all over the place, but it's a concern, and people need to know the strategy that's being employed. And then, of course, we're going to talk about this No Kings protest and how the organizers are trying to justify Christian involvement in it. I thought that was fascinating. Now, it's supposed to be happening right now across the country in reaction to what happened over the weekend in Los Angeles. Also, the military parade that Donald Trump has going on right now in D.C. I have not seen anything materialize firsthand, but after I'm done with this protest, you can pray for me. I'm going to be driving to an area where there is supposed to be a protest, and we'll see if anyone's there. And if there are people there, if they're willing to talk, I'm going to try to see if I can talk to them. So we'll see. Someone already sent me some pictures of the one in their area, and it looked pretty pathetic. Not a lot of people, mostly older folks. It does beg the question, what happened? In 2020, there was all this energy. You saw some energy last weekend in California. What happened? I have a gander. I have an idea. I can take a gander at it, but I don't know fully what the explanation is. I know some people say, well, that was a unique time when people weren't working, so now they have to work, so they don't have time to protest. Others say, actually, the young people are just disillusioned. They're tired of protesting. They got bigger problems, especially financial problems. That could be true. I mean, there's probably a combination of things, but I think one of the things that actually factors into this is the fact that I think that you have to have a demographic that's willing to protest. I know that seems obvious, but you have to be able to tap into something that's real. It can't all be AstroTurf. I think that's one of the things that conservative, and this is goes for boomers and zoomers, actually, because there is this notion that the issues are always external. It's Chinese communists. It's before that, the Russians. It's Muslim terrorists. It's something external that's causing the problems. That's more of a, I'd say, a boomer take. The zoomers tend to be more likely to say it's an element, it's the boomers, or it's Jewish people that act as a subversive force internally in the country, but they're really, they're external to American interests. So it's still not Americans. There's no American radical tradition that's doing this. And what I think, obviously, there's narratives to be examined on all the fronts that I just mentioned, as far like, obviously, China is interested in destabilizing us and fomenting things. But here's the thing. I don't care how much Soros money you have. You have to have people who are willing and motivated on the ground at a large enough scale to have a protest, especially one that's going to turn into violence and police and the bricks and all that kind of stuff. And I think you had that over the weekend in Los Angeles, because there were people who actually do, if you have ever been to Los Angeles, they actually do have a vested interest in keeping ICE out of there. It actually does, in their minds at least, threaten their way of life if ICE starts rounding people up and deporting them based on their immigrant status, or that their illegal immigrant status, because there's so many illegal immigrants in Los Angeles, or the children of illegal migrants, or people that have a vested interest in keeping migrants who are here illegally in the country. So you're going to get a match between the donors who might be interested in this, and then the foreign forces, or even the internal domestic forces that are interested in chaos and opposing Trump, and then those on the ground who actually agree with the message. I think you actually have to have both. I think that's what happened in 2020. Yes, there were Chinese communist groups that were behind much of what was happening. You had the Liberation Road Group and others. I know Trevor Loudon's done a lot of work on this, but you also had to have a bunch of people, namely college students and also even in some cities, minority classes, who were conditioned into blaming the structures of the United States for their plight. Without the connection, you don't have the protest. And there's something that's disconnected right now. Something is disconnected. Maybe the money's there, right? You could say the money's dried up, but it seems like there's some organizational power still there, but there's not the interest in protesting as much. So we'll see what happens at the end of the day. Maybe there will be some big protests in this No Kings thing, and maybe it'll materialize. But so far, what I've seen, doesn't seem, and this is what I expected, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of interest in that kind of thing, which is interesting to me. So is there rioting right now? Ask Cosmic Treason. I don't know of any rioting going on right now. Over the weekend, like I said last week, I saw some. We were destabilized way before China's emergence as an economic power. Yeah, you could say that we were destabilized as when the ink on the Constitution wasn't even dry yet. You could say that there was instability there for sure, just between the four British folkways that existed in this country, especially between Southern interests and Northern interests. WTV Henry says, my wife said that Summit Church has attempted to take over the church in Knightdale. Yes, we're going to talk about that. So, I've kind of organized, I would say, or helped organize the team that, did the documentary for that particular story. And it is, an incredible story. Go watch it if you haven't yet. We'll talk more about that. I'll take any questions you have on that. I run my church's live stream, says Justin, and can totally sympathize with weird, inexplicable glitches like that. Thank you, Justin. I don't know what to make of it, but I decided to restart the live stream. So here we are. All right. Well, I gave you my thoughts on the protest. And since we've been talking about the protest, why don't we just keep talking about it? And I will save the SBC stuff for later. Here is, I think I deleted. No, I didn't. I didn't delete it. Good. All right. So here is the No Kings protest document for Christians, or it's called Faith Resources, so more than just Christians, put out by the Kairos Center. It's compiled by organizers with the Kairos Center. Now, I'm kind of curious. I'm looking this up in real time to see what the Kairos Center is. It is a movement to end poverty for religion, rights, and social justice. There you have it. And who are the people behind this? Have we ever heard of them? Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, Reverend West McNeil. I've never heard of these folks. Looks like it's more mainline people. Let's see, in the about, our mission staff. Let's see who the staff is, if we recognize everyone. I don't recognize anyone on this staff list yet. My world is more the evangelical world, so that would not surprise me if these are more kind of out there figures. Yeah, I don't recognize anyone. Okay. So it's a social justice over, and that's what they say about themselves. It's an overtly, oh, the Poor People's Campaign. Okay, I recognize this. I've definitely heard of the Poor People's Campaign. I thought Jim Wallace was also involved in that. I don't see his name coming up. But anyway, social justice group. Who knows? I don't know where they are getting their money, but they were part of this and they put out this resource. So for those who know about the No Kings protest against Donald Trump, by the way, one quick other comment on this. This is interesting to me. I think Nate Fisher brought up a similar point, but I've been thinking this for a while. Let's see what Nate Fisher's point is here. He said, No Kings is interesting evolution from previous focus on dictator or Nazi accusations. I could see it accelerating a re-embrace of monarchy on the right. Yeah, because the right seems to just try to mirror. It's still, we've never escaped this, right? You know, you try to craft a positive vision, but it's like just whatever the left does, we want to do the opposite. That's what it's been in the last, in recent years. Leftists previously attacked characters, but open online discourse has destroyed their power to define characters. Now they are directly attacking what they hate, strong personalized authority. The left wants a world ruled by bureaucrats and algorithms. A central theme of the right could become the opposite, ruled by people. And this isn't, you can see if you're watching a ad taken out in a magazine. I don't know what magazine, maybe the New York Times. Okay, there you go. No Kings, June 14th, mobilize. We are a people of principle and honor. We honor our commitments and stand by our allies. We defend against aggression and dictators. We uphold and defend the Constitution. We care for veterans and children. We respect our neighbors and trading partners. We support a healthy national and international economy, community, and environment. We are the world leader trusted to uphold stability of rule of law. Most of us would agree with most of the sentiments here. And I think this is an attempt to Americanize the left. Think about it this way. Over the weekend, you had all these Mexican flags, right? And organizers started trying to get American flags into the hands of the protesters in Los Angeles because it was a bad look. And I think, especially post-2020, the people who are just your normal, everyday, decent Americans have been turned off to the social justice stuff. They're not interested in what the left's selling as much. And for those who say, oh, the left doesn't, you know, they have their bad actors and they don't have to answer for it and that kind of thing. Well, kind of. They just lost an election because of their bad actors. They kind of do have to gatekeep their bad actors, and they have a trouble doing it because the cat's out of the bag. But I think this is an attempt to actually Americanize, repackage some of the left stuff so it doesn't look so foreign. You have the Statue of Liberty on this ad in the New York Times. Let's wrap it in the American flag a little bit more, and let's make it sound pretty American so it can appeal to the normal average working class people. And No Kings is a pretty quintessentially, I would say, appealing message for Americans, right? Isn't that how our republic formed in the first place? We didn't want a king. So we decided, George Washington could have been a king, but we decided not to go that direction and instead to have a separation of powers and federalism. And so that's what we have. And I think most of us in this audience are grateful for that. Maybe some of you are monarchists and aren't grateful for that. But either way, this is more of an appealing message to Americans. So this is supposed to be an opposition to Donald Trump, obviously implying that Donald Trump isn't this way. He is, in fact, a king. And maybe they'll get broader appeal if they don't use the word dictator, but use the word king. So here's the faith resources. No Kings. There is an interfaith litany, which is a reading, I guess, that you would say in church. So reader one says, we stand today in the long tradition of prophets, spiritual leaders, and freedom fighters from our sacred traditions who have also stood up. That's interesting, sacred traditions, right? Like, it's, normally the left isn't really that big on tradition, but they do have, there is an American radical tradition, guys. There just is. You can't not study American history without coming into this, and it does predate the large groups of immigrants who came here. You could say certain immigrants groups have expanded it, changed it, tapped into it, but they have not started. Feminism is a good example of this. Feminism, it was mainly people that lived in the Northeast who were of English heritage. Their great-grandfathers would have been Puritans that started that particular movement. So anyway, I digress, but using the word tradition here is interesting. Who have stood up to the empires, kings, and unjust rulers of their day. Today we are taking to the streets nationwide with a clear message, no kings. Reader two, as we stand together today, I invite you to join us. Each time we say no thrones, no crowns, you respond with no kings. So there's this reading and everyone just keeps it, kind of gets everyone into this tizzy of no kings, no kings, no kings. But they cite, obviously, Islamic sources, the Quran. They cite Hindu sources. That must be, it says, Shatapatha, if I'm saying this right, Brahma. So it must be part of the Bhagavad Gita. I can't even say it. It's been too long since world religions. We had to read all these sources, and I can't even remember the way to pronounce half of them. I've been steeped in, Muslim stuff a little bit, but Mormon stuff. I haven't had to navigate conversations with a lot of Hindus lately, but they want Hindus to join their protests. So we'll see. It's an interesting choice too, right? They're choosing to, so from Islam, from Hinduism, and of course they do quote, or they try to summarize a quote from Jesus here. So you have Christianity. We believe statements. So we believe that healthcare is a fundamental right, not a privilege. So here's the socialism. We believe that no child should go to bed hungry, that every child deserves a quality education. We believe that this moment demands moral clarity. Woe to you who deprive people of their rights. We stand together to call for justice, dignity. So it's all positive rights. It's all you need to have healthcare. You need to have all these privileges given to you. We believe in an America where we care for one another, no one that divides and destroys. We believe that. So, I mean, you're right. It's only Trump that divides and destroys. We believe that now is the time for all hands on deck. So most of this is fluff. Most of this is just motivational, crowd-pleasing things. But then embedded, obviously, is a socialist underpinning. There's a prayer here, God of justice, God of liberation, in these dark times, in these destructive ways of kings and empire. So it's. Have you ever noticed that the left, it's always in the name of the people? They will have their communist dictatorship, but it's always the people's republic of this or that. It's always somehow in the name of the people that they're doing everything, but it's the most dictatorial regime. But if the right even says, you know what, we're going to, you've had an imperial presidency since Abraham Lincoln, and with notable figures like Woodrow Wilson and FDR and Obama and others that have expanded the executive, I think we're going to use those same tools. All of a sudden, it's a king. All of a sudden, it's a terrible, terrible thing. And, you know, I had said I think it was the last podcast or two podcasts ago, I said, look, what Donald Trump's doing in Los Angeles, technically, if you want to be an originalist, it technically isn't constitutional. You can't just, without Congress's approval, nationalize the National Guard. Even if you want to talk about the Insurrection Act, it's narrow parameters. Under the circumstances Trump was operating in, you do need the state to authenticate federalizing the National Guard and all this. And of course, a judge just threw the hammer down and said, you were wrong to do this, which we should have all expected. And it seems like the Trump administration is abiding by it, right? I also saw Donald Trump the other day saying, we got to take care of our farmers. We can't just have these rounding up illegal migrants on farms. And it's disappointing in a way because, you know, I think I was very much in favor of, look, we're post-constitutional. We need a country. If we don't have a country, we're cooked. We're toast, right? We're just going to balkanize and we won't have peaceful solutions. We're actually kicking the can down the road for a much less peaceful solution in years from now, maybe in our children's generation. So yes, if we're going to operate on the precedents that those before us who are on the left have used in the presidency, and let's face it, there are precedents for this. During the civil rights times, you did have presidents like Lyndon Baines Johnson federalizing the National Guard without state approval. So why can't Trump do it? I don't know. I mean, it's not according to the original intentions of the founders, but I was kind of like, you have to, like, there's no other recourse. What other options do you have? We're out of constitutional remedies. California is not just going to leave, right? So you remember all that. I said that if you watch the podcast or listened. Now, here's the thing. If you're going to do that, though, if it's the no kings, right, and it's this imperial presidency that you have to be consistent with it and say, you know what? I don't care about your court order either. I'm saving the country, right? But I don't think the backbone isn't there to do that. I don't think it's going to happen. They're going to abide by the court order, it seems like. And it's just like, it's, I don't know. It's like, if you're going to go in, you have to go in all the way. If this is really about saving the country, then we have to, you have to be about saving the country. We can't start making exceptions. Like, well, those who contribute, the illegal migrants who contribute, like, we'll leave them alone. We're just after the quote unquote criminals. It's kind of an all or nothing thing. Like, sure, prioritize those who are here doing violent crimes, prioritize those who are in places that you can more easily get to them without interference and so forth. But at the same time, if we are at red alert level, if it's stage four cancer, then you have to go for the whole thing. You have to just say, we are going to take every measure that we possibly can and push as hard as we possibly can to save the country. And that means inspiring the many millions. And we don't know how many are here, but you know, it could be up to 50 million, who knows, right? We're going to inspire them. And maybe even some of the children and others who are technically they're born here. So, you know, they're Americans, but they're connected to these people. Maybe they would leave too, but to self-deport. That's the only way you really handle this, feasibly speaking, that you have to inspire people to self-deport because you don't have the manpower. So anyway, that would be, in my mind, if Trump were to do that, which some of us were thinking, maybe that's what he's going to do. It doesn't look like it, but if that's what he was, that would be, okay, you have a king arising. Okay, you have the imperial presidency forming, but a court order stops him. So I don't think so. So the left, again, going nuts about something that's not really happening, saying no kings, implying Trump's a king, and then trying to justify that. I guess that's what Christianity teaches, right? We are of the people, for the people. We aren't about kings. But meanwhile, the left is the one that expands the power of not just centralizing power in DC, but the power of the presidency in particular and the courts more than anyone else. It's not something that conservatives have done. Here's all the scriptures that they say, you know, Amos 5 apparently is against kings. I hate and I despise your feasts, and I will take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Yea, though ye offer me burnt offerings and your meal offerings, I'll not accept them. Neither will I regard the peace offerings at your fat beasts. What translation is this? Take thou away from me the noise of thy songs. This is King James. The these and the thous are there. Let me not hear the melody of the psalteries. Okay, so you keep reading. There's nothing against kings here. Micah 6. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come with burnt offerings, with calves? No, the Lord's not pleased with that. To love justice. So it's just words like justice, kindness, walk humbly. That must mean no kings. Here's more scriptures. Jeremiah says, so they give you all these scriptures. 2 Kings 4. Let's see here. Does that say no kings? How can I set this before 100 people? He repeated, give it to the people and let them eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left. And he set it before them and they ate and had some left according to the word of the Lord. This is Elisha talking. It's against Baal. Okay. I'm not seeing the narrative here. I mean, they got their scriptures, but it's pretty obvious this isn't supporting the narrative they're trying to make it support. So wealth should not be concentrated in the hands of the few or those deemed holy, but should be given to the people in abundance. So redistribution of wealth. I guess that's what Elisha wanted. He wanted the redistribution of wealth. It's just scripture after scripture setting. It's all the imagery getting set free from Pharaoh in captivity. So use these passages to justify our socialism. So this is overtly communist stuff. And let's see, is there anything else of note here? It's basically a guide for leaders on how to lead your faith community to support the No Kings protest. So great. The No Kings protest has their faith arm. I would be curious. Someone could put in the channel if you know who's funding this. I haven't looked into it too deeply, but it would be interesting. All right. We are going to switch gears here. I'll come back to this if there's comments on it, but we're going to talk about Southern Baptist stuff. And I'll quickly get to some comments. No Kings is quintessentially left wing. The left and right paradigm pertains to French Parliament pre-revolution. Right defended church, bourgeoisie, and monarchy. The right acknowledges hierarchy. Yeah, I think that's a correct take, right? The right is pro-hierarchy. That's why the idea of woke right is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard, because woke is egalitarian. It's against hierarchy. In theory, we all know that hierarchy is inevitable. So once you say you're against hierarchy, you have to come up with a hierarchy to enforce your non-hierarchy. So obviously it's a lie, but that is the ideology of the left. The ideology of the right, ideologies, are all interested in some kind of hierarchy. And you could even say, people say, well, fascists aren't conservative because they're socialists. And that true to an extent, but and operating on an American paradigm, they're certainly not conservative, but they do believe in hierarchy. Even if it's a racial hierarchy, there is a hierarchy, right? Having a monarchy is a hierarchy. Having a landed gentry is a hierarchy. Having a natural aristocracy, like Thomas Jefferson talked about, is a hierarchy. Having a federal arrangement is a hierarchy of some kind. The right is pro law and order and on hierarchy on some level in some way. The left wants to deconstruct all of that and then somehow come about with this leftist utopian equality vision that we will never actually achieve. Shout out to the Anglo-Protestant descent reformers. Okay, thanks, Terry. thanks for the shout out there. The documentary on Faith Baptist Church and their resistance to takeover from Summit is well worth a watch. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Okay, let's see. Anyone else commenting here that I want to get to? I don't see any questions, so I'm going to keep going here. Oh, okay, so we have one last thing. Besides Walmart, Princess Act Blue, and the Chinese Communist Party, from Anna Luna Paulina in Congress. So I think Congresswoman Anna Luna Paulina says that there are some corporations and some hostile government forces that are, and Democrat Party forces that are behind the No Kings protest. All right. Well, I haven't verified that, but that would make sense, I suppose. I'm kind of curious how Walmart factors into this, but okay. Ironic that the courts didn't stop Joe Biden from forcing an experimental injection on the nation. The courts are a joke. Yeah, fair enough. I wouldn't try to dissuade you of the courts not being a joke. Let's talk about the Southern Baptist Convention. Now, I have a video queued up. I can't play all of this because it's kind of long, but we're going to go to certain parts of it. And I will, as we get to them, give you some commentary. There are a few things of note to talk about. First of all, we had the law amendment. The law amendment was an attempt in the prior year and this year to enable the credentials committee for the Southern Baptist Convention to disfellowship churches with female pastors. They are empowered to kick out churches that have sexual abuse problems, that have problems with quote-unquote racism. But for some reason, not this issue, and they're resistant to this issue. And once again, the effort failed. You had about 61% that were for the law amendment and against it about 39%. But it needs a three-quarter threshold, so 75%, if I'm not mistaken, threshold to pass. And it did not reach that threshold, so it did not pass. And this is very comparable to the numbers from last year. It seems like over the last year, the numbers have not moved at all. You had the same percentages. Now, different numbers in the there was more people who voted in last year, but same percentage. Maybe a little more voted for it. So you could say maybe the numbers are slipping a little in favor of the more left-leaning faction, but not by much. So it was around 61% last year, too, that repelled this effort to enable the credentials committee to kick out pastors with female, or kick out churches with female pastors. Now, this issue has arisen because there's a lot of churches in the Southern Baptist Convention that have staff using the term pastor who are female. And because of that, it shows a confusion because their doctrine says you can't have that, but yet you have it. So if the credentials committee is enabled to kick people out, then it solves that issue, or at least helps remedy it. The issue I've said is that even if you enabled this, personnel is policy. So will the credentials committee actually act to do it, even if they have the power to do it? And the answer is probably not. But the way that it is working now is if you have to submit a request, or you have to let the SBC executive committee know that you have a church that should not be in friendly cooperation because they have a female pastor, and then it gets submitted to the Southern Baptist Convention to disfellowship. If you just enable the credentials committee to disfellowship, they could just do it without that approval. That's the idea. But it keeps getting rejected. And this is a low bar. Like, this is, I think this would have passed even like in 2019. I suspect that this probably would have passed. And I don't know, I could be wrong, but it just seems like this is such a low bar because you have people from the Gospel Coalition like Juan Sanchez and from Nine Marks like Mike Law and from Southern Seminary like Al Mohler all supporting this. And it still fails to pass. You still have enough people that are left-leaning in the convention or scared because they think it'll cause legal problems, which is the biggest joke I've ever heard. The chairman for the executive committee came out and said, well, this might cause us legal trouble. And you're like, says the committee that was perfectly fine waiving attorney-client privilege a few years ago. That's kind of weird, but I don't know what legal problems it could possibly cause. I mean, it doesn't seem to cause any problems kicking churches out that have sexual abuse issues. So I don't know why this would cause a problem. It's in their documents, but you might have had some people voted it for that. But either way, the platform doesn't seem to want this to pass for whatever reason. And so it's not going to pass. That's the bottom line. You also have, this was another big thing, the ERLC. The ERLC, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, was able to survive again. There's an attempt to abolish them. Now, this is kind of too close for comfort, but still, the ERLC had about 57% of the room. This would have just taken a majority vote, and 57% of the room decided to retain the ERLC. So you still are stuck with the ERLC and Brent Leatherwood if you're a Southern Baptist. Conservative loss on that. What issue is this? NAM. And okay, so I'm not going to play this for you, but there was a messenger who got up there and tried to say, look, NAM was supposed to conduct a survey on churches that were assisted using cooperative program funds 10 years from their launch to see basically if they're still using those funds. So to see, are we actually using our money in a fashion that makes sense? Because if churches are still using cooperative program money, if they're still dependent on the Southern Baptist Convention for their very survival 10 years out, then that's a waste of money. And the messengers had requested that NAM conducted a survey, but NAM hasn't done it. So why? And Kevin Ezell, the president of the Northern American Mission Board, basically gives a political answer and says, we appreciate the recommendations, but we don't have to do what you say. And that's the bottom line. That's it. That's the only answer he provided. And if I played it for you, you'd probably be more annoyed. But I'm just trying to give you the facts here. I may not play any of these videos. I'm not sure. It's too sad. So here's another one. So another conservative loss on that. Conservative loss on this. John Jones of Cadet Baptist Church asked the IMB, International Mission Board President Paul Chitwood, if the IMB plans to drop the vaccine mandate for missionaries. And basically, if you want to sum up what Paul Chitwood says, no. No, because a lot of missionaries came off the field in 2020 because of the mandate. Paul Chitwood is saying, yeah, nothing's changing there. He's still going to have the mandate. So I would say, if you want to say that's another conservative loss, that's another conservative loss. You have Pastor Tom Askell and Tom Buck later also made a motion or seconded it. I don't remember. But Askell makes a motion that the messengers hear about how Mike Stone was slandered last year and owe an apology. I think this was 2021, if I'm not mistaken, but there was a situation where, who was it? Now I'm trying to remember. I don't know why his name is escaping me, but Mike Stone was accused essentially of, meeting a quote unquote abuse survivor in a, less than friendly manner. And there was a scene that was caused, and it was this whole push for, you know, quote unquote abuse survivors that I think it was 2021 that ended up making its way into the room. And then you had Grant Gaines on the microphone, making an emotional appeal that ended up eventually in the situation where the executive committee waives attorney-client privilege, and they start constructing an abuse hotline to report churches. And now they're being sued all over the place because of using this mechanism to disqualify people or prevent people from certain ministries because of tips they received, but they didn't go through the legal process. And everyone who was anyone who had any common sense warned that that's exactly what would happen. Surprise, that's what happened. And so Tom Askell is going out there and he's saying, look, you had Mike Stone who fell short. He was very close, but he could have been the Southern Baptist president. And he ends up getting accused, and there is camera. There's a camera, I guess, feed that caught this altercation where he supposedly offended an abuse victim, and it is not being released. Why can we get it released? Could we get Mike Stone vindicated? That's the plea here. He was accused. There was a hit job on him. There's evidence that would vindicate him, or maybe it would show that everything that was said about him was true. But can we see the footage? Can we roll the tape? And the answer is no, no, this, you can't have nice things. That will not happen. So there was a vote taken, the vote lost. I move that the messengers to this convention request that the SBC executive committee to investigate two separate claims made by one of its former chairmen. So so one was 2021. I was right, by Griffin Gulich. He was the one that made the accusation I was referring to about Mike Stone. And then the other one maybe that's the one from Russell Moore. I'm not sure. But there were two apparently cases of slander, and the SBC the room is not going to allow that information to come forward, apparently. So there you have that. That's another conservative loss. You have Rhett Burns making an amendment to have more financial transparency. That's something the Southern Baptist Committee Convention has needed for a long time in their entities. There's a lot of suspicion about the entities. And here you have the executive committee president, Jeff Lorg, who's the one who I just referenced before, who was saying, well, if we pass a law amendment, we'll have legal trouble or something like that, who then gives an argument for why the Southern Baptist Convention doesn't need their money being spent on producing 990s and having financial accountability in that way. Because, well, we already have a financial accountability through the trustee system, which is this in-house system, which the conservatives in the convention have been saying is corrupt for a while, or is corruptible, and we're just supposed to trust that now. So that ended up being another fail. That did not go through either, unfortunately. That was another conservative loss. I'm not happy about any of this. I don't know what to say. Like, I don't know what to say. It's just conservative losses all over the place. I will say there was one highlight here. This is another thing. So Clint Presley was basically ran unopposed. Someone nominated David Morrell from Protestia, who's super conservative. He got almost 7% of the vote. So Clint Presley, landslide. But it was a shoe-in, right? Clint Presley has been pretty diplomatic. The only thing I know that he's done that I wasn't too hot on, and I haven't followed him closely, though, was he did speak, I think, it was the executive committee a few months ago, and basically say, like, we don't have any accountability problems in the SBC. So other than that, he hasn't rocked the boat like previous SBC presidents, certainly not J.D. Greer at all. And so he's got broad support. I mean, that's how you get. Maybe his presentation's pretty good. I'm not going to lie. He's got an accent you could listen to. I just want him to do audiobooks, to be quite honest with you. Clint Presley has a nice accent. He dresses very well, you know. You'd have guys go up there before looking kind of sloppy, and he kicks it back to like the resurgence days. He's got a 3-piece suit. His hair is well maintained. He's not J.D. Greer. He doesn't look like a youth pastor up there. He looks like an adult. And I have to say, image does matter. And that's one thing Clint Presley does well. I can't say much more about Clint Presley because I just don't know enough. Jeff Lorg also said that during the convention, apparently, that millions of dollars are needed to continue fighting these sex abuse lawsuits. They've already sold their property in Nashville. They've already taken from the executive committee reserves to fight these things, and they need more. They need millions more to fight these things. This is the kind of thing that ends the SBC, because you get into financial a position where financially you can't do anything. You're just hamstrung. And unfortunately, I think that's where it's going. And there's no signs I mean, I think there are signs that they've realized, oh no, this was a mistake, especially the waiving of attorney-client privilege and the trying to do this hotline to investigate or let other churches and entities know that there's a tip on a alleged abuse person who has supposedly been accused of abuse, even though we're not going through legal channels on this or law enforcement channels. I think there's wide understanding that this was wrong, but they don't know what to do about it at this point. Like, the cat's out of the bag and the damage is done, and it's going to continue to be done because the lawsuits are ongoing. So anyway, that's SBC stuff. I didn't play any videos, even though I had it all queued up, and I don't know that I will. And that's kind of a change for me. I think I probably speak for a lot of you that I see the political necessity in making the SBC conservative and or keeping the conservative things that are still very much part of the SBC. Their amendments actually this year, this is the first year I saw since I remember that there wasn't a resolution on anything racial. As long as I can remember, there's always been something racial. There's always been some kind of racial virtue signal. There wasn't one this year. This is the first year I've ever seen that. I think that's interesting. I was expecting something on immigration. They didn't even touch it. What does that say? I don't know. They're playing it cool. They're playing it careful, maybe. But I think the SBC does serve a political purpose in a way. Like, it's the largest Protestant denomination. And the guys who are in it because they see the political necessity of being in it, I get it. I think that political conservatives are interested who aren't in the SBC because they know that this is the base of the Republican Party. But if they don't show up at the annual meeting, if they're not actual Southern Baptists, it doesn't really do you any good. You could apply external pressure politically, but that's not the politics of the room. The politics of the room are all that matters for actually getting power in the SBC and changing the direction. So here's the disconnect. There are guys who care about ministry, and that's most of the people involved in the SBC. That's why a church gets involved. They want to do ministry. They want to do missions work. They want to fund education. They want church planning. Well, if they feel like the SBC is spending money on abuse, lawsuits related to abuse reform or abuse accusations, or if it's going to causes they don't believe in, or if they can't police their own doctrine, they're going to pull out because they don't see the necessity. Their money could be better spent and their time could be better spent by investing it in actual ministry. Then you have guys who are politically minded, right? And those are the guys who think our church needs to stay in the SBC for a political fight. We'll give the minimum amount and we'll spend the money and time going to the convention every year to get our guy in. Now, I'm not saying either of those is wrong. I definitely lean towards the ministry side because I think that's the reason you have a denomination or an organization like this. And if that's the reason you're in, then you're in a bind, essentially. Like, you stay in, and after loss every year, it gets tiring and your people want to know why they're expending effort and money towards something that doesn't seem to be giving any ministry return. I empathize with that, or sympathize. Can you say empathize anymore? I sympathize with it quite a bit. And I think if I was in that position, I would have left a while ago, because that's the purpose of the organization, right? But I also understand and sympathize with people who want to make this the political fight that it is. They see the significance of that. And if their church is willing and they say, this is part of our ministry as being salt and light, and we're going to be that needle in the side of the SBC every year, then okay. But the only way you win is you have to be activists like the left is activist. It's going to be, you know, every year we're not going away. We're going to keep pushing till we get our way. And you have to be able to convince hearts and minds and bring more friends. And based on the numbers from last year to this year, I don't see any significant movement on the law amendment, for example. Like, there has to be more. There has to be a momentum. So I don't know what the plan is, but there has to be another plan for getting that kind of momentum. That's my assessment of the situation. Now, the biggest story, I think, for the Southern Baptists last week was not the SBC. It was actually this, and I'm not just trying to toot my own horn. I actually think, though, this mattered more than anything that happened in the Southern Baptist Convention. And this is an article that I wrote. I'm not going to talk about this in detail. I'll probably do another video where I talk more about this and I give you some more background, but I would encourage you to go look it up. American Reformer, Silent Takeover. It's called How Evangelical Churches Are Being Remade from Within. And it is a long article, as you can see. And I spent a lot of time writing this article. And I outlined three different situations where I helped organize and helped produce documentaries on church takeovers. And the first one was in Naples, Florida. The second one was McLean, Virginia. And the third one was Knightdale, North Carolina. Two of them were non-denominational. One of them was Southern Baptist already. And I give you all the details that are relevant for what actually happened in these three cases. And then I put the pieces together for you. That's the contribution I've made. I put the pieces together to show you what the formula is. What exactly are they doing? How are these conservative churches, or you could say maybe a better word, more traditional churches, why are they going progressive? Or a better way to put it is, why are they going modern? Because it's bigger than just politics here. What ends up happening in each of these cases is you have a new pastor or new leader coming in with Southern Baptist connections of some kind who has a formula in their mind for what they want to do to a church. And the church has people in it who will be resistant to that formula. So they have to consolidate power, which means they have to neutralize opposition. That's what happened in all three of these cases. One of the tools that's used is a consulting firm, an outside firm that comes in, whether it's Oxano or it's a business consultant in the case of McLean, or it's someone from an organization like the Unstuck Group, and they come in and they tell you all the things that you probably already thought, the agenda you already had, they're going to reinforce it. And they're going to say, you need to get rid of your choir. You need to get rid of this. You need to get rid of your children's ministry, all these things. And you got to change the look of the church and the feel of the church. And that flag could offend people. Get that American flag out of here and get, you know, whatever it is. They fundamentally give the justification for remaking your church. And in this process, people who are part of these legacy ministries of the church that are so fundamental to the character of the church end up getting canned. And you start identifying who the rebels are going to be, who are the people who will resist these innovations. And once those people are identified, then they're marginalized. They're either stripped of their voting privileges, they're called names, divisive, racist, whatever. And they become an enemy that you can freeze frame, to take from Alinsky, right? You freeze them, you marginalize them, you caricature them, and then once they're neutralized, you can keep on your merry way with completely fundamentally remaking the church that you have been given charge over, you've taken over. And that's what's been going on, right? And I give you details in every single case what's happening. And it's really a way to reconcile, once you're done with all these changes, the church with a modern, not just progressive, but modernistic kind of cultural feel, style, vibe. You take out the things that are patriotic. You take out the things that remind you of tradition. You take out the things that look like a church. We don't want steeples. We don't want remnants of the past. In the case of the church in Florida, in Naples, they took out this. I didn't know this until a few weeks ago when I was writing the story. They took out a shovel for the foundation, digging the foundation. Took it out and replaced it with bolt cutters for breaking the chains that are holding the church back. I mean, there's a lot of symbolic stuff that's been happening. You take out the children's ministry decor, spend tens of thousands of dollars to do it, and just replace it with bland drywall. Repaint the iconic red roof gray, a bland office gray. It's down to that kind of thing. It is stripping the character, attacking the identity of these churches, and then remaking them in a new modern image. And one of the troubling things about this is it's also happening with satellite churches, which apparently 40% of the churches that satellite church that become a satellite, become a campus for another church, like some has 12 of these, right? 40% of those churches in the United States, supposedly, according to the Unstuck group, are mergers, quote unquote, with traditional local churches. In other words, it's reshuffling the deck. It's taking a church already in existence and then taking its assets and making it part of this satellite church. It's the Walmart of Christianity. It's coming into the community. And the last place that community might have that's not subject to corporate or market forces, where you can actually have a little tradition, a little bit of community, a little bit of the old, it's a little bit of a uniqueness. It's going in there and it's destroying it and saying, you know what? You're going to also be subject to global market forces because we're making you part of this new vibe, this new style that's basically has corporate interests. That's what I see going on. This is bigger than just social justice. This is a fundamentally new way to do church, to think of church. It's a spectator thing. It's not a place you go to for, I mean, there's going to be a lot of talk about community and that kind of stuff, but it's actually a place you go to as a spectator where there's a show that's put on and it's very micromanaged. It's very, so anyway, go read that article, go check it out. I talk about this in detail and I'm really happy that part one and two of that documentary are out now. Go support that. Go share those things. If you, you know, if you have any connections with media beyond this, share it with your friend who's in media, because this needs to get out there more. People need to be warned that this is happening in their church. And if that's too long of an article, go to the Federalist. And that's not the article from the Federalist. Let's see. That's not how I was reading this article, but that's not the article. But let's see. You could probably search my name. Let's see. If you search my name on the Federalist website, does it come up? No, it does not. John Harris, the Federalist. Let's see if we do a search. Okay, it comes up if you do a search in Google. And then, beware of the progressive playbook to modernize conservative Christian churches is the article. It is a shorter version, more digestible. You know, send that to whoever that you think this would be relevant for, because they need to be warned about this play. This play is being run on a lot of churches, and I have not put the pieces together fully until now. This is probably one of the most important things I've ever done with my platform, and I want it to make a difference. It already is. So anyway, that's all I'll say about that. I don't know if I want to say much more about the Israel situation. That seems like in the middle of it, if you want any kind of responsible take, you just end up getting lambasted by all sides, which is kind of what I'm interested in. I'll just say this. I think it's a complicated situation. Here's, you know, the Epoch Times, I think, is doing a decent job. Obviously, they're more pro-Israel. But, you know, you could read the Epoch Times and then read the New York Times if you want your more anti-Israel kind of, read on this. But long story short, in my opinion, is you had Trump doing negotiations with Iran. He wanted them to back off some of the uranium processing that they were doing. And they didn't want to back off of that. The negotiations were failing. Israeli intelligence apparently thinks that they were threatened by imminent attacks, and they wanted to take out three of the commanders that, let's face it, if they're Iranian commanders, Iran wants the death of Israel. They want Israel completely destroyed. And so they took out Hussein Salami, Mohammed Hussein Bagheri, and Ghulam Ali Rashid. And so they do these tactical strikes. Then Iran strikes back, destroys some residential, I guess, areas in Israel, which is super sad. And now the United States is kind of like pressured to do something. And as far as I know, other than contributing perhaps some intelligence, because I think Israel's an ally in the region, and then selling them weapons and that kind of thing, the United States has not gotten directly involved in any of this. But you have to think through some hard questions when you're navigating something like this. It may be that you don't like Israel or Iran or both of them, right? And it may be that you're like me and you just think we have a lot of big problems in the United States. We don't need to be putting our efforts and our resources towards these foreign things, especially when Israel seems like they're capable of defending themselves. And we are the ones for years that have been holding them back. So just let them have it out. Though it's kind of like where I've been coming down on this. There's no good solution to this. You can't just be against something. You also have to realize that any kind of positive situation is any result of any policy isn't going to result in a positive situation. There just isn't one. Iran wants Israel destroyed. Israel is rightfully feels threatened by Iran, and Israel doesn't want to be held back from taking military action against Iran. It's a war. It could be cold at times. It's a war, though. They hate each other and want each other defeated in a military way. There's no, like, Trump wants to lessen the amount of deaths. He wants negotiation. There is no negotiating ultimately with these two parties. You can't give them each something that they want, because what they want is the defeat of the other side. And in the case of Iran, the destruction completely of Israel. And Israel's never going to trust Iran. So there's no basis really for getting a peace deal. That's the problem across the board with Middle Eastern stuff. And it's been that way for years. It's going to be a war. There's just no other way to actually solve the situation but a war. Someone gets defeated, someone conquers. And the United States has been, and not just the United States, but the West has been somewhat interested in balancing the power and keeping these regions from killing themselves, kicking the ball down the field, kicking the can down the road. It's just, but ultimately something's going to break. It can't keep that going that way forever. These sides are not adjusting to ever liking each other. In fact, the intensity seems to just get worse and worse and worse for how they feel about each other. So that's the problem. And if you're an American, obviously, you know, any American with common sense would rather go to Israel than Iran. Where do you travel, right? Even people who hate Israel normally rather go to Israel than Iran, because of you're much more, Israel is much more compatible with the West than Iran is. And it's much safer to go to Israel than to go to Iran under, you know, most circumstances. So I think most Westerners are going to be, they're going to recognize Israel. They're going to see Israel as more compatible. They don't really want the, I think deep down, most even anti-Israel people in the West, I could be wrong, but this is what I this is my gut. I don't think they really want the destruction, the total annihilation of Israel, but that's what would have to happen if you go pro Iran, right? There's no good side is what I'm saying. There's no good outcome. There's really no good side. And Israel defending herself is probably about the best you can find in this. And you could say Iran defending itself too, if Israel's going to, you know, send missiles in to attack their generals, right? They both are thinking that they're defending themselves. So anyway, I feel like there's no reason to adjust the stance that I've had now for a few years on this, which is personally, I don't want to see Iran successful. I think it's a hotbed for the kind of Islamic terrorism that would expand beyond Israel. And there's the real present danger of what's happening in Europe. I remember when I was in Turkey a few years ago, and now more than a few, yeah, 2017, there was a lot of Iranian refugees and so forth. And I was with a ministry that reached out to them, and it's just not a good situation. And they're imperialistic. They want to subvert culturally in ways that are very violent, sudden, and revolutionary. And when Israel's the target now, but I realize that expands because it's an Islamic caliphate they want ultimately. So are my sympathies going to be more with Israel? Yeah, I think most people's are in the West, in America in particular. But at the same time, we don't have the resources. We don't have the bandwidth. We got our own problems. And if it's going to be solved by war, I hate war. I don't want to see war, but it seems like there's no other situation. So that's all I'll say about it. It's another way to solve this. I think, you know, what's happening now might be the best thing, to let Israel do what Israel's going to do, to not keep yanking their chain, and to then stay out of it. as much as possible, which is what Marco Rubio at least says that the United States is doing. And I appreciate Marco Rubio saying that. I also appreciate him saying, hey, look, I'm the Secretary of State for the United States, not for the world. And we need more of that. We got to be America first about these things. That's part of the Ordo Amaris, but it's also the only option we have. We can't keep pace with the helping the rest of the world at the rate at which we've been doing it for years because we're broke. Surprise, surprise. So that's my opinion on it. I'll take questions, and that was probably more than I wanted to say on it, but I don't really want to say much else. So, and then I will, Lord willing, maybe next week or the week after, I'll have a show specifically on this, the church takeover situation. There's more I want to play that I haven't gotten a chance to. Greer is probably going to try to defend himself. He's already hinted at it. David Platt has already tried to defend himself. And the strategy they're taking, I don't think is going to work, but it's the only option they have. They're going to have institutional support, but their names are going to be marred with the people who have seen those documentaries, which is why they need to go far and wide, because this is how they're held accountable. But I do have more thoughts on kind of the source of the multi-site church and also the church takeover and why this is happening. So, all right, I'll take some questions. So, John, you don't think Israel is a totalitarian state that wants to rule the world, says Vocal Pelican. I don't think, well, you got to make a separation between, and this, I see these two things conflated all the time. You have Jewish people who live in, this is the basis of the Jewish conspiracy stuff, right? You have Jewish people who live in various countries in the world who have, who tend to be represented in financial industries at higher numbers, right? And so this is often equated with an international agenda because these are people that are into finance, but they don't have, often they have a preference more for those who operate in their class and their financial class than those, let's say, in their own country, right? And so there's a lot more that can be said here, but I take that as something very separate from Israel as a country. Israel as a country, if you look at polling, even in the United States, evangelical Christians in the United States are more pro-Israel than Jewish people in the United States. In fact, there's a whole lot of Jewish people who are marching in these anti-Israel protests and so forth. So you do have to, I think, if you're going to be responsible in thinking through these issues, you can't just like whitewash everything and be like, oh, it's all the same thing. You know, Jewish people, Israel, different sects of Judaism, secular Jewish people. And so, like, you have to start making these distinctions when you're talking about these things, or else I think it gets you into a weird place where, you know, Israel, I think, has been trying to, if as a country they are trying to dominate our government, you know, you look at things like AIPAC, right? And the special relationship that Israel has with the United States, a lot of that has to do with wanting to ensure that they can survive. They're a small country. They're surrounded by a lot of enemies with higher populations and even more wealth. And so they're very shrewd, though. And, you know, do they want to dominate the world? Not in the same way Islam does. If they do, it's more they want to influence governments to support their existence, right? I think with Islam, though, if you understand the mind of I guess radical, I'm trying to use a different word, but radical or a fundamentalist, you know, an Islamic person from the Ayatollah Khamenei or something, they have a very specific eschatology where they are going to dominate the entire world and convert everyone to Islam by force, if necessary. And this is now happening in Europe, where there's places that are just under Sharia at this point. You don't see the same kinds of things with Jewish populations, and they don't have the high enough numbers, and they're not working at the behest all the time of the state of Israel. So it is a much different situation. I see these things conflated all the time online. It's just insulting, in my opinion, to our intelligence, but that's my thought on that. So no, I don't think it's the whole thing. I don't think the two are equatable necessarily. But that's the problem, says Vocal Pelican. Too many evangelical Christians think the Jews are God's chosen people, not since 70 AD. Well, you definitely have evangelicals that have been used to support the democratic liberal order. And yes, some have used dispensational theology to try to justify that. But Zionism predates. Zionism actually, if you look at the history of Zionism, there were even quote-unquote anti-Semites involved with that. There were a lot of postmillennialists involved with that. There are people who weren't Christian at all. There were actually a few dispensationalists at the beginning. And I think it's whatever ideology is going to be, can be used to justify the liberal order, and that's what Israel, honestly, that's what they symbolize, a Democrat liberal order in the Middle East, where there's not a lot of liberalism. It's going to be, different reasons are going to be given in different countries based on their populations for why we ought to support this, why we have a duty. And Israel isn't stupid. They're smart. They know what buttons to push to try to get people to support them. And, using the Holocaust, the fact that they are a liberal democracy and they have more in common with European liberal democracies, using a Christian tie to the Holy Land, there's all kinds of things that they're going to use. So, maybe my stance on this is the reason why the guy, what's his name? The founder of National Conservatism. I'm trying to remember his name now. Yoram Hazony. I just found out Yoram Hazony just blocked me on X. So I'm like, what did I do? But I think it's because of my foreign policy is too. Maybe it's perceived as anti-Israel, even though, my sympathies are with Israel. But I'm I understand wanting to survive as a country. I understand that, even if your country, it's since 1948. Like, I understand though, but I still think America first foreign policy. Maybe that's enough to get me banned from the pro-Israel guys. What consequence, if any, will come following the information revealed in the documentary? The consequences are already there. It just is a bad look, honestly. And it will help churches who understand now what's going on, how this is happening. They will be ready for it and they will guard against it. That's the point. Getting a He Gets Us ad before watching John's episode exposes woke Big Eva. That's pretty funny. What a waste of an ad. Hi, John. I'm sure Heritage Americana is identified as anti-Semitic by the people using that label to marginalize people on the right. Yeah, I'm sure it is. It's frustrating. It's like if you're about American heritage now, like you're evil on some way. You're in league with neo-Nazis, right? According to some of the liberal guys. That's true. Thank you, John, for sharing your insights. I appreciate it. Well, thank you, Debbie. I appreciate you listening. There is no negotiation with evil that is close to a nuclear weapon. Iran, before the takeover by fundamental Islam, was not pushing the destruction of Israel. Yes. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, Iran, you look at those old Iranian photos from like 1971, and you're like, man, like it used to be such a different place, and it's not anymore. And the problem is, like, you go into Iraq, same thing, right? You take out the dictatorship, destabilize the region. What are the options in Iran? Like, I don't see good options. Faith Baptist Church showed a great resolve. Yes, they did. They need to be supported, by the way. They're going to have tremendous pressure if they don't already. Don't we need a deeper look into the Unstuck group? I have looked into it somewhat, and sure. Yeah, I mean, I would welcome deeper looks into all of these things. What was one of the first things Jesus said when the Spirit descended onto him? Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. Seeker-sensitive churches do not teach repentance. That's very true. FBC Durham, pastors Andrew Davis, member of TGC, teaches at SCBTS. Church is not listed on nine marks, or church is listed on nine marks. Yeah, I was a member there for a semester, so I know all about that church. And one of the reasons I didn't decide to go back to the church after I had left and then come back to seminary was because, yeah, they had been going down that woke path. And I actually offered Andy Davis, if he was against it, which he said he was, that he could come on the documentary Enemies Within the Church, talk about it. And he he didn't want to do it. So I don't know what to say, but I don't know why FBC Durham, FBC Durham is Andy Wood. No. Okay. So someone, this was a comment correcting a previous comment identifying him as Andy Woods. It's Andy Davis. So I don't know why Andy Davis is coming up in any of this, but yes, he is in Raleigh or Durham, I guess. And let's see. Jason Little is no longer at Facebook. Okay, I'm not going to get into the specifics of this. You got to read the article because the article talks about the situation in more detail. Like I said, I will likely have more to say about this, but it is an in-depth piece from me, okay? I haven't put out stuff like this for a while, so check it out, and please share it, support it. This is probably my big contribution, I would say, bigger than anything else I'm saying on this podcast, so... appreciate your support. It's the only way that I can do this kind of thing. And another thing, stay tuned. I don't know if anyone in the audience gets the Fight Laugh Feast magazine, but they're going to be featuring, at least I'm told, an article I submitted yesterday on natural law and theonomy. Check that out. That's coming out soon. And yeah, I hope you all have a good weekend. Have a good Father's Day too. Have a good Father's Day. That's tomorrow. I'm going to be leading music in church. So it's my first Father's Day as a father. I guess you could technically say, right, my wife was pregnant last time, so I guess I was a father then, but no, this is like, you know, I have a child who's almost a year old, and so I don't know what that means for me. Do I get chocolate? Do it, like, what do I get for Father's Day? Someone tell me what the Father's Day, what does it mean? I've never done this. I guess I get to grill, but that's what I do anyway, right? I mean, that's what you, you grill steaks on Father's Day. That's our tradition. We don't really do much else. And dad gets chocolate, right? He gets a chocolate bar and a steak. And what else could you really want though? Right. I don't know. I can't think of anything. So you get to be told to do better. not at my church, not at my, hopefully I think there's going to be a section in the service where we honor fathers. So I get a new tie. That's right. Vocal Pelican says I get a new tie. I think that is a tradition in some places. I do need a new tie. I get these, you know, striped ties, patterned ties. I actually need some solid ties and actually some solid shirts and some more sport coats. I need all of that stuff. Come to think of it. If you look at any of my presentations, I have the same sport jacket, the same tie and the same shirt, except I'll switch like two shirts out in all my, wherever I travel, wherever I go. Now everyone's going to notice it. I wear the same stuff, but you're right. I'm going to use this to get like a Men's Warehouse certificate. The Harris household, you go get your hair done. I just had a haircut this morning. What's wrong with my hair? Are we related? I don't know. I mean, that's another Harris household out there. So getting my hair done. No, not getting my hair done. Reverse seared steak cooked in a South vibe is a pretty good idea. So if you don't have a Sauvide, am I saying it right? That's a gift. See, I don't even know how to pronounce it. So of course I don't know what that is. So maybe that's my Father's Day gift. All right. Matthew 21, 33 through 44. Go read it. Why should I read it? Matthew 21 is about, let's see, that particular section is the parable of the landowner. What does this have? Why am I? I'm ending the podcast. I'm sorry. I don't have time to read that passage right now. Maybe next time. All right. God bless. Bye now. Have a good Father's Day.